Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife issued its first order and permit to kill up to four wolves this year in early April, after wolves in eastern Oregon's newest wolf pack, the Pine Creek Pack, killed three calves and injured four more in Baker County. This kill order was given in spite of the fact that Oregon's wolf population increased by just 12 confirmed animals in 2017, while there has been nearly a 30% reduction in wolf-livestock conflicts. So far this year, three wolves have been killed by the ODFW. But Oregon is not alone in its efforts to roll back wolf protections that have promoted the wolves' return to the state. Today we talk with Amarok Weiss, West Coast wolf advocate for the Center for Biological Diversity, about federal and state efforts to delist wolves across the West and what that means for the fate of wolves in the contiguous United States. Amarok, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. Really glad to be here.
Well, it didn't seem to be that long ago that the state of Oregon was totally in love with this wolf, OR7, who wandered across the state and down into California and I guess started his own pack in southern Oregon around the Rogue. Following news reports in the last few years, you think that there was this tidal turn in thinking about wolves in Oregon and that we were ready to embrace them. But when I heard the news last month that there was this order to kill the wolves in Baker County, it seemed like, well, maybe there's a disconnect between what's going on in the popular consciousness west of the Cascades and what's really going on in both the legislative end of the state and also with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, not to mention the ranchers in eastern Oregon. So what is going on?
Well, I think you put your finger on it. You know, right now in Oregon, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is killing wolves on behalf of the livestock industry. And this is extremely disturbing because it's the very reason that wolves were nearly wiped out in this country 100 years ago. And then at the same time, over the last few years, we've seen the department move towards wanting to give members of the public special permits to shoot and trap wolves to assist the agency, even though a 2015 survey showed that 72% of Oregonians oppose using hunting as a management tool for wolves. But what's really a travesty about this is it doesn't have to be this way. You noted yourself this love affair. The OR7 story, it wasn't just in Oregon. It wasn't just in California where he came into. This was reported on worldwide. And part of that is because in the past, Oregon's state wolf management plan and how the agency implemented that plan on the ground used to be a model that conservation groups extolled. It actually exemplified how we can live with wolves, allow them return to lands they once called home, and at the same time, it kept conflicts to a minimum. It held the agency and livestock operators to very practical standards, and it ensured that there was transparency for all the public, no matter what your viewpoint is on wolves. But in the past few years, as you've noticed, Oregon wolf management seems to have slipped from its moorings, and the result has been premature removal of state protections for wolves in Oregon, a lack of transparency by the agency, and wolves being needlessly killed. And then we're seeing the same thing happening in Washington state, where that state's wildlife agency is rushing in to kill wolves more quickly without targeting specific problem animals, and then it's doing the same thing every time that there's a predictable and avoidable conflict instead of learning from past mistakes and instead of listening to what the current science is saying. This is kind of the really exciting story that's been coming out of wolf recovery for the past 20 years, which is what science is telling us is that killing wolves to try to resolve conflicts is counterproductive. It's the exact opposite of what we should be doing in order to live with wolves. So we have, we have a little bit of what I would call maybe a Northern Rockies wolf management mentality seems to be seeping into Washington and Oregon, despite the fact that most of the population in all three West Coast states, Washington, Oregon, and California, support wolf recovery, want wolves protected here, and want the agencies to focus on non-lethal conflict deterrence methods instead of simply killing wolves.
Well, I want to make a couple observations that, to me, indicate some of the problems with getting Oregon totally on board with encouraging wolves to return to the state. Back when, before there were any wolf packs in Oregon, and wolves have been reintroduced to Yellowstone, and I guess, were they also reintroduced in northern Idaho? I'm trying to remember if they just migrated from Wyoming.
Yeah, in central Idaho, actually, in the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness.
Right. So there were definitely like a concerted effort to reestablish wolves in Yellowstone National Park and in Idaho. And then some of those pesky Idaho wolves had the notion that they could cross the Snake River and come into Oregon. And I don't remember how many times these wolves, I think two or three did this, and the wolves were returned summarily back to Idaho. At least they weren't killed. But it was like, we don't allow wolves in Oregon. And I thought that was rather strange at the time. And of course, after a while, that attitude was shifted. And then wolves, the reintroduction of wolves into Oregon was encouraged. But around that same time, a friend of mine from California was traveling in eastern Oregon. He came to the town of Joseph. And I was commenting on how much I love Joseph and, you know, how progressive Joseph seems for eastern Oregon. He said, all I saw were these really anti-wolf signs everywhere. And it was kind of a wake-up to me to realize that there is this real disconnect between the attitudes about wolves in eastern Oregon and west of the Cascades. I wanted to talk a little bit about what that disconnect is about and how that also connects to how long it took Oregon to basically more just change attitudes, but actually change regulations so that we could encourage the Idaho wolves to start settling here.
Yeah, so a couple of points on what you just said, which were fascinating to me following wolf recovery as wolves started to come into Oregon, because I've been doing this work for about 21 years. I used to live in Oregon. I was on the wolf planning stakeholder group there. Same thing here in California. And, you know, what we saw in Oregon, first of all, when wolf B-45, it was, came over from Idaho. You're right. The feds picked her up in their helicopter and took her back to Idaho. And that's because the state of Oregon didn't even realize that Oregon had wolves listed under their own State Endangered Species Act, that they were protected and they were supposed to leave them alone. They figured that out within about a year after a number of us notified them about their Endangered Species Act. And then a few more wolves started to come over also on their own. Unfortunately, those were either found killed by gunshot or struck by vehicles. I think three of them were found killed by gunshot illegally. And so it actually took until about 2008 for the first confirmed wolf pack in Oregon to be discovered. And so from 2008 until now, in 10 years, the wolf population has grown from zero wolves and wolves just starting to come in to the wolves that we have today, which is 124 wolves. And that might seem like a lot to people. It's actually not. The state of Oregon has been researched in terms of how many wolves it could support. And scientists believe that Oregon could support up to 1,400 wolves. And actually right now they're only occupying less than 12%, or right around 12% of available suitable habitat, which is now about half of what their habitat once was. So we have plenty of spaces for wolves in Oregon. And polls going back even to 1999, when B-45 first came in, showed overwhelming support for wolf recovery, even when the poll divided up the state by regions, so that even in the eastern portion of Oregon, I believe it was over 60% of people wanted to see wolves recovered in Oregon. So although your friend is seeing all those anti-wolf bumper stickers or posters, that actually represents a small portion of the population in eastern Oregon, but they're a very vocal population.
Well, what is this division? I'm assuming that the support for wolves in eastern Oregon is probably not large amongst ranchers, though it seems like also a large percentage of the population in eastern Oregon are ranchers.
Again, you're correct that a large proportion of the people that do not want to see wolves recover, whether it's in Oregon or elsewhere, are folks from the livestock operation community, the ag industry. And again, this goes back to a cultural view. We killed wolves in this country on behalf of the livestock industry. It's really important to remember that about wolves as an endangered species, because most endangered species we lose in this country because we destroy their habitat. That's not true with wolves. We lost wolves simply because we killed them by the hundreds of thousands. Wolves are very adaptable. They can live wherever people will tolerate them. And so it's this issue of human tolerance that comes into play. And with the livestock industry, the viewpoint towards wolves is very frequently that they can't live with wolves, although there are some livestock producers who are willing to try non-lethal measures and are finding success with them, which is great because all the science that's coming out in the last decade or more is showing that killing wolves is far more costly and far less effective than using non-lethal measures.
So what are some of the non-lethal measures that people should be trying?
So this can be really case-specific depending upon what the terrain is, what kind of livestock operation you have, whether it's cattle or sheep, whether it's a large public lands grazing area that's very challenging to get through, you know, rugged, forested, rocky terrain, or large open pastures. So things have to be specific to the type of operation, but they range anything from having human range riders on riding on horseback, sometimes on ATV. And what that means is not monitoring where the wolves are. That means monitoring where the cattle are, making sure your cattle are bunched up, just like native wild ungulates bunch up to protect themselves from predators. One of the reasons that there are problems sometimes between wolves and livestock is that modern ranching practices have cattle spread out all over the place and able to bunch up and protect themselves just by naturally standing their ground. So range riders can effectively keep cattle bunched up together. That keeps the cows and their calves together. If you're grazing sheep instead of cattle, then using livestock guarding dogs can be very effective, and that involves having a sheep herder there who can be alerted when the livestock guarding dogs start barking to notify of wolf presence. And that's exactly what livestock guarding dogs do, is they don't chase after or attack wolves. They notify the sheep herd, a sheep herder who can come out and then make a loud noise, bang pots and pans, scare the wolves away. And there are a whole range of livestock guarding dogs, different breeds from different European countries that have been used for centuries that are now being used in the U.S. On top of that, there are things that are scare devices. One is an item called fladry, and this is red flagging hanging along a rope, and you put that rope on a fence line. If you put it on electric fence, we call it turbo fladry. What the fladry does is it provides a psychological barrier. We don't know why, but wolves find those red flapping flags in the wind very scary, and they don't like to go through them. So that can be an effective barrier around a smalling grazing operation or a penning area where your sheep are lambing. And then there are things like actual noise devices. There is a radio-activated guard box that was developed at the recommendation of a rancher who said, well, you've got collars on those wolves. Why can't we do something that notes when the collars comes in and scares off the wolves? So the radio-activated guard box, you affix it to a fence line with speakers, and when a radio-colored wolf approaches, it picks up the signal and sends up all kinds of really loud, scary noises. It sounds like Apocalypse Now. It's gunshots and helicopters. Scares the wolves away, but it's also a data-collecting device. There's a little computer in there that can tell you which wolf came in, how often did they come back, or did the first time scare them away altogether. There's the use of biofencing, actually taking wolf urine from wolves that don't live in the area and placing it around the area that lets the local wolves think, oh, there's a pack here. I better not cross into this territory. There are so many actual means of preventing conflict deterrence that are really quite common sense, like removing bone piles. That's probably the most common sense one of all. In the absence of large predators like wolves, livestock operators have gotten used to when their cattle die from birthing complications or ingesting poisonous weeds, they just leave the carcasses there to rot. Well, that draws in predators of all kinds, and if you're going to be drawing in predators and you're going to draw them in near to where you have your live livestock, then you're causing the problem. So getting those bone pits buried or burned or hauled away, that's a really effective technique.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Amrik Weiss, who is the West Coast Wolf Advocate with the Center for Biological Diversity. And we're talking about the need for continued and maybe more intense protection of wolves in the western states and how that's being undermined by a lot of state policies that are happening towards wolf killing. One of the things that is going to cross my mind is that people, I mean, and I understand that ranchers and a lot of other people kind of confuse coyotes and wolves sometimes, and that one of the excuses for shooting wolves is that somebody thought it was a coyote and it turns out to be a wolf. What are the big differences actually between the relationships that coyotes and wolves have both with humans and with human livestock, with the livestock that belongs to humans?
Well, see, first of all, if one's going to mistake a wolf for a coyote, I suggest studying some charts to understand the differences between them, because they're pretty striking. Wolves are much bigger animals than coyotes. Wolves weigh anywhere from 65 to 150 pounds at the very largest, but most of the wolves that are in Oregon, for instance, are maybe around 100 pounds. Coyotes weigh maybe 30 to 40 pounds out west. On the East Coast, they're a little bit bigger. That's a pretty big size difference. Wolves' face is much broader than a coyote. Their muzzle is much broader than a coyote. Their ears are much broader and shorter than a coyote's. Their paw sizes are much larger than a coyote's. All of them, even their scat is larger than a coyote's scat. So these are all signs that you can look at to make sure you know what it is that you've got in your sights. As far as a relationship with other animals on the ground, because of this size difference, wolves are really built to take down larger animals like elk and deer and even bison. Coyotes tend to take down much smaller animals, although they could take down a deer possibly or a deer fawn. So in terms of wild animal, there's a difference there in what they're feeding on. Coyotes tend to eat smaller animals than that. When it comes to livestock, you will tend to see more livestock predation on sheep by coyotes than by wolves. With wolves, you tend to see more calves. Yeah, more calves. And I think that some of the same common sense practices would work with coyotes as work with wolves, specifically the burying of the bone piles and also having human presence there. I mean, that's everything. You know, what business owner wouldn't want to be around to protect their wares, right? So I think that one of the other maybe biological differences your listeners might be interested to know is that in this country, because we killed wolves throughout the country, eradicated them from everywhere except for a tiny pocket of small northeastern Minnesota, because of that, this niche opened up for a canid carnivore predator. And as a result, coyotes have spread much greatly throughout the country in places they historically did not exist. They can't totally fill that same role of the wolf, however, because they don't take down large prey like deer and elk and bison. And I guess one of the other points to that is because coyotes have become so ubiquitous in this country, we have launched on a killing escapade with coyotes the same way in this society as we did with wolves. One thing about coyotes, though, is as you kill more of them, the more of them there are. Basically, coyotes have a mechanism called compensatory reproduction. And what that means is if you're going to start killing the breeding coyotes in an area, then other coyotes in that area that weren't going to breed are now going to breed, and they're going to have larger litters than they would have had if you hadn't been killing coyotes in the first place. So all of our decades of coyote killing have resulted in more coyotes throughout the country. Just another piece of proof that killing is not the way to resolve conflicts.
But when you kill wolves, it's very different. I mean, because we did just about extirpate wolves from the continental United States.
Yeah, you know, with wolves, there have been some recent studies on what happens when you kill specific members of the pack. Because now that we have wolves that are starting to recover in just a few parts of the country, it's really important to understand what are the dynamics if you do ever end up killing a wolf to resolve a livestock-wolf conflict. And so understanding, first of all, that wolves, they're a social unit. They're family. You know, for years we talked about an alpha male and an alpha female. Well, what are they really? That's a mom wolf and a dad wolf. And a typical wolf pack is a mom and a dad wolf, their puppies from this year's litter, some yearling pups from the year before litter, and then maybe some aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters of mom and dad wolf. And this is a multiple generation family. The research that's been coming out of Yellowstone is definitively showing that wolves thrive when they're allowed to have multiple generations within that family unit. They have different roles. They have different skills. Some are better at chasing prey. Some are better at taking down the prey. Having a whole family allows the mom and dad to go off hunting and leave a babysitter teenage wolf in charge of the pups so that the pups are safe while the pack is hunting. So when agencies begin to kill wolves, and particularly if they are randomly killing wolves without trying to target a specific animal that they've identified as a problem animal, they're just running rampant in terms of the social structure of that pack. And what the science is showing is that if you kill a breeding male or a female, or if you kill both of them, it greatly affects whether the pack even continues to exist. The pack may split up into two or three smaller packs. We've seen this happening in Washington directly in the last few years. Packs may dissolve entirely. Pup reproduction can be down or cannot be successful at all. So when we start killing wolves without the awareness of what we're doing with their social dynamics, we not only destroy packs, but we can end up increasing the conflicts, because by splitting these packs up, they're less capable of hunting together to take down a large animal like an elk, and they might turn to smaller prey like livestock. And if you kill the breeding animals, you have lost the teachers from that pack who would have taught their youngsters how to successfully hunt native wildlife, which are very hard to hunt, by the way. It's dangerous for wolves to hunt native wildlife. They get killed and injured all the time. So you kill those breeding animals, you leave the untrained teenagers behind. They may be more likely to go for easy prey, like livestock. Lots of repercussions that are unintended from killing wolves.
It actually makes me think about war-torn countries where family units are torn up by the war and adults are killed, and you have these kind of feral teenagers running around, and it seems like it's like the seed beds for like ISIS and things like that. And in a way, it's maybe a little bit of an exaggeration to think about the wolves, but what you're describing, actually, it seems like when you break up the social fabric of the wolf society, you are going to create kind of antisocial behavior, and it's probably antisocial behavior both within their community and also towards the human community as well.
Well, and you know, you don't just create antisocial behavior on the part of the wolves. What the science is showing is you actually create anti-wolf behavior on the part of the society that you think you're appeasing by killing wolves. Because for years, agencies have said, we need to kill wolves in order to maintain social tolerance for wolves. We need to kill wolves in order to save them. Well, first of all, in 2006, a federal court ruling on a case in the Western Great Lakes said, what nonsense. There's nothing to show that you have to kill wolves in order to save them. But beyond that, there has now been science that comes out of a research lab at the University of Wisconsin, the only carnivore research lab in the world that has specifically studied this phenomenon. Do people actually build more social tolerance if agencies kill wolves or if people are allowed to hunt wolves and kill them themselves? And what they found is exactly the opposite. Then when agencies kill wolves, it seems to send a signal to the public that wolves are no longer valuable and they should be killed. And when they allow people to kill wolves themselves, again, the same message. And what has happened is that measured social tolerance for wolves under those circumstances actually has declined, and there's been an uptick in poaching. So we're seeing more illegal killing of wolves as a result, in relationship to the agency sending a signal that we don't need to protect wolves anymore. We can start killing them now. And in fact, we have seen this very phenomenon happen in Oregon, because in 2015, the State Fish and Wildlife Commission prematurely stripped wolves of protections from the State Endangered Species Act. We and two other groups have sued the state over this. That lawsuit is still pending. And in the meantime, we've seen a huge uptick in poaching in Oregon. And in fact, just this last year, of the wolf mortalities, there were 13 that were discovered in 2017. Of those, 12 were human-caused, and 4 of those are known poaching incidents. And what the science on poaching says is that for every known animal discovered, there are at least 1 to 2 other animals that have been poached that will not be discovered. So it's a big problem. It has huge ripple effects.
Well, another distinction between wolves and coyotes, at least that I understand, is coyotes are a lot more tolerant of being close to human beings, evidenced by the fact that they're living in cities all around the country right now, and we've got quite a few in our neighborhood. And wolves, on the other hand, my understanding is that they really don't like to be around people. They're very shy. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Wolves are very shy. If you are in the wild and you see a wolf, if you have the ability to pick up your camera and take a photo, go for it. You're really lucky you saw that wolf. And if you don't want to ruin that moment, just leave your camera right where it is and just watch that fleeting glimpse of the wolf for a moment. There are some times that wolves are curious, and they will stand and look at you, and people think, oh, this is a bold wolf, this is an aggressive wolf. No, that's not the case. Usually in those cases, those are youngsters, yearling wolves, who've never seen a person before, and they're just curious. For the most part, if wolves see, smell, or hear you, they are gone before you'll ever see them.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Amarok Weiss, who's the West Coast Wolf Advocate with the Center for Biological Diversity. And we're talking, I think, partly about how wonderful wolves are and why we need to appreciate them. We're very fortunate here on the West Coast that they've been reintroduced and that they could possibly thrive were it not for state agency practices. So let's talk a little bit now about why you thought the Oregon Wolf Plan was so good in the past and what has changed to make it enable, for instance, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to go out and put a kill order on 4 wolves last month.
The Oregon Wolf Plan was first adopted in 2005. It's supposed to have an update every 5 years, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But the way the Wolf Plan was developed is what is called an adaptive management plan. And it divided the state in half. It set wolf population goals for each half of the state. And it set up a system by which protections for wolves would be very conservative, very protective during what was called phase one. And as wolves increased in numbers and breeding pairs for a certain number of years, then it would move into phase two, and then it would move into phase three. One of the trade-offs in the Oregon Wolf Plan is that the population goals that were set were pretty low, and not scientifically established, not anything a scientist would say is sufficient for full wolf recovery, but the trade-off was that the state would then agree to allow to have wolves recover throughout the state. That this was part of the trade-off in the stakeholder group that the agency oversaw in developing the plan. When the plan started being implemented as more wolves began to appear on the landscape, initially the agency was following the conservative protective measures for wolves in phase one, and then we began to see pressure from the livestock industry apply to the agency to move much more quickly than the plan allowed to kill wolves. And when this came about, my organization, the Center for Biological Diversity, and 2 other organizations, Cascadia Wildlands and Oregon Wild, filed a lawsuit against the state, establishing that they were violating actually their own state Endangered Species Act in killing wolves. As a result of that lawsuit, there was a settlement that was reached that provided even greater protections in phase one for wolves. And the thing that worked about phase one for everybody all around the table is it had great certainty and it had great transparency and everyone knew what to expect. And it was very protective of wolves, but at the same time was very common sense in its approach of making sure that livestock producers were doing what they needed to do to protect their livestock. The agency was working with them to identify what measures, as I mentioned before, on a case-by-case basis, would be most effective for their operation. And it had requirements for the agency to be very transparent with the public. When wolves were known to be occupying an area, they would put out a map called an area of known wolf activity. If there were predations that happened, then the agency would put out a new map that showed an area of depredating wolves. As it advanced along this spectrum, more and more non-lethal measures had to be implemented so that every effort was made to try to resolve conflicts non-lethally before resorting to lethal methods. And the threshold was that there had to have been at least 4 confirmed wolf predations on livestock within a 6-month period within a very defined geographic area, and the agency had to be very transparent with the public every step of the way as to what was happening and what they were doing, what the livestock producers were doing. When wolves met the phase 1 threshold, we switched into phase 2 and then quickly into phase 3 in the eastern half of the state because of the wolf population increase. And what that meant was that now all the cautious approach to wolf recovery was off the table. The agency could move to kill wolves much more quickly, didn't have to be in a defined geographic area. The specifications for transparency and what livestock producers and the agency had to do were far less great. And as a result, we have seen in the last few years the agency resorting to killing wolves much more quickly.
Well, I'm wondering why it moved so quickly from phase 1 to phase 3. And I know that I was reading the comments on part of a number of scientists who were writing in opposition to Oregon delisting the wolf, which it did 2 years ago. But that there seemed to be like no science to really support moving so quickly to killing wolves. So what were the pressures? Why did things change so as much as they did so quickly?
So first of all, numbers-wise, things move from phase 1 to phase 3 fairly quickly simply because in any recovering wolf population, it's pretty common for there to be about a 30% per year wolf population increase. So once they kind of hit that threshold of phase 1, it didn't take too long before the population to get to the phase 3 levels. Unfortunately, because of the state delisting of wolves, and with now the increased poaching, we actually immediately saw a precipitous drop in what that annual wolf population increase was. The year after wolves were delisted, we saw only a 1.8% increase in the wolf population. And last year, we saw only an 11% increase in the wolf population. This is quite a bit lower than that 30%, which again goes back to my theory that what we're seeing, supported by science, is probably more wolf poaching. In terms of why the commission went against all the science, all I can say is that there always has been a tremendous amount of political pressure from the livestock industry and the sports hunting industry against wolves. And even though Oregon is a very progressive state where the vast majority of the public wants wolves recovered, protected, and restored throughout the state, the vocal opposition from the livestock industry and the sports hunting industry holds political sway in the commission and at the legislative level. The scientists that wrote into the commission at the time it was considering delisting were numerous. There were 24 scientists who wrote in after reviewing the delisting proposal to say, this is counter to science. Wolves are not recovered here. They're still threatened by a number of factors, and they're not even in 90% of the habitat that's still suitable for them. All of those comments were ignored. No one from the agency or the commission called any of these scientists to discuss their viewpoints. The scientists actually even sent in comments on how to improve some of the analyses that the agency was doing. Nobody called any of the scientists to discuss the improvement suggestions. So what we've seen is that no matter how much lip service is given by the state, by the commission, by the agency, that their mission is to protect and conserve wildlife, it's very clear that their focus is on shootable, huntable, fishable wildlife and not on all the rest of the wildlife that are quote-unquote non-game species that the public so much loves and that our habitats so greatly need for environmental health.
Well, I'm wondering about ways that there can be a reconnect between the incredible enthusiasm for wolves and public enthusiasm for wolves in the state, and getting that to be reflected in the political reality. I'm thinking about the news last year that there was a new wolf pack in the Mount Hood National Forest, that the wolves had actually, I guess, they're sort of still like on the east side of the Cascades, but they're in the Cascades now, as opposed to being in central and eastern Oregon. And it seemed to be like real excitement about that. And combining that with also talking about some of the amazing ecological services that having an apex predator like wolves back in the ecosystem as they used to be. If there's ways to talk about that and generate a lot of public enthusiasm, more than that, incredible passion, that maybe things can shift. And maybe some of that has to do with also changing things through the electoral process as well.
I think it's really important for everyone to realize that they have a voice in all of this. They have the most wonderful opportunity to go visit with their own legislators, to go visit with the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission members. You know, call up, get an appointment with these folks. Everyone has a senator and a representative in the legislature that they can go meet with. They need to hear from you, and so does the commission, because otherwise all they hear from are the people who don't want wolves there. And I think that some of the really key information that people need to get across to their legislators and to the commissioners is how many people in the state like their wildlife alive. You know, there was a study that came out by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I think almost every 5 years, and the last one came out in 2016. And across the country, there's 11.6 million people that are spending money on hunting. There's 35.8 million people spending money on fishing. There's 80.6 million people spending money on watching wildlife. I don't have the figures for Washington, but in Oregon, in Washington, out of the 7.5 million people that live there, about 69,000 hunt, about 750,000 fish, but 1.8 million people go out and do recreational wildlife viewing, hiking, photography. This point needs to be brought home to the people that represent you in the legislature and the commission, because they're supposed to be representing your views as well. And so I really encourage people to make the time, find out who your representative is, who your commissioner is, give them a call, make an appointment, go see them. I recommend that people right now in Oregon should call Governor Kate Brown. They should tell her that they expect her leadership in directing her agency to ensure that Oregon Wolf Management and the State Wolf Plan prioritizes conservation over killing and science over special interests. Same thing in Washington. I encourage people to contact their Fish and Wildlife Commission there. Tell them the same thing. And then in California, we're not quite at that point here yet, because wolf recovery is so brand new here. We have so few wolves in California at the moment. And under the California State Endangered Species Act, actually, the agency can't kill wolves. But this means that everybody needs to pay attention. Look for news releases from California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Any news stories about wolves, if there's any conflicts reported on, make sure to write letters to the editor to counter any inaccurate information and to impress on all the other readers that current science says non-lethal methods are more effective, they're more cost-efficient, and that we can live with wolves. So I think it is really up to all of us who are the vast majority, who want to see wolves back here, are thrilled that they're coming back, to speak up as often and as loudly as we can.
Well, in a lot of the comments from the scientists who are opposing delisting the wolves, they were talking about some glaring holes in the scientific information that was included in this decision. And one of the pieces of information that really struck me was the very important role that an apex predator plays in the entire ecosystem. So it's not just the importance of protecting wolves, but actually how does having wolves back in our ecosystem protect the entire ecosystem?
You know, I like to think of nature as a tapestry, and it's elegant and it's intricate. And if you look at any part of it, it is just fascinating and beautiful, but it's the sum of its parts. And if you start to pull threads out of that tapestry, it starts to unravel and has far-reaching consequences, in this case, not just for wolves and not just for other non-human organisms, but also for other organisms throughout the environment and for human health and well-being. And what we have seen since wolves have come back, and this was to your point that one of the scientists commented very strongly, that in the recent proposed updates by ODFW to the state wolf plan, they'd almost completely eliminated all mention of how important wolves are in ecosystems and a phenomenon called trophic cascades. And what that phenomenon is that predators eat prey and prey eats vegetation. So there's a relationship there between the health and well-being and thriving of all three of those organisms. And probably in the last 20 years, 25 years since the reintroduction of wolves to Yellowstone, that's actually been the most important science story coming out of the return of wolves, that they're integral to making sure that deer and elk herds stay healthy and that the deer and elk herds then don't over-browse on vegetation that other species need for nesting and roosting and for streamside bank stabilization and for beavers to build dams and ponds that fish and frogs need to thrive. The threads of that tapestry are interwoven through every little piece of nature, and it affects us as well. And people really weren't aware of this story, although it was starting to come out with other species like sea otters, like starfish. So we have trophic cascades in marine systems, too. We have top predators in marine systems, too. The public wasn't really aware of it until wolves were reintroduced and studied, and scientists began to see what happened to ecosystems when wolves came back. And that's a phenomenal story. And in order for people to understand why we would care about wolves, it helps to understand all the amazing things that they do. So that's an important science story that needs to be back in the wolf plan.
And how do we get it back in there?
So the wolf plan update, as I mentioned earlier, was supposed to have been done in 2010 and then 2015. The 2010 update was done. The 2015 update has been delayed for 3 years. The agency and the commission are in the process of deciding when they're going to next hold public hearings. When there are, the public can show up and testify. They can write comments. One of the things you can do is you can go to our website, www.biologicaldiversity.org, to find out more information about our wolf work. If you sign up for our alerts, we can advise people when those commission hearings will be, when they can come and testify, and also even give them some tips on some of the key issues, including these very science issues that would be great for them to testify about.
And we have a link to your website on our website, so people can go to the Locus Focus website for today, and you'll be able to find out how you can get more involved in commenting and protecting the wolves in our state. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking with Amarok Weiss, who is the West Coast Wolf Advocate with the Center for Biological Diversity, about the importance of having wolves coming back to our ecosystem. In the last part of the show, I'm interested in looking at how we change attitudes. And I thought, well, here we are, I'm a city folk, and there's a lot of the listeners are city people, whether you're listening in Portland or Seattle or wherever else today. And for us, loving the wolves and wanting the wolves back in the state, it's somewhat intellectual, because it isn't affecting us personally in the same way that ranchers perceive the threat of wolves to their personal lives and livelihood. But what we do have here is kind of a miniature threat, which is the coyotes who have returned to the cities. And I was thinking about how a lot of us city folk are having to deal with the reality of coyotes, and some of us are trying to adapt. I mean, and the big one is keeping your cats inside, especially at night. But the other part of it is I hear people who want to go out and shoot coyotes, and every time a cat is killed in their neighborhood, they say it's time to go out and that coyote patrol and kill coyotes. So I think it's important for us in towns where we are supporting wolves in our minds to look at our own visceral response to the coyotes who we are living with now, and it might help us to empathize more with the ranchers, and maybe we can help them to find a way to overcome their fear, because I think there's something, we have such ingrained fear of wolves that, societal, going back to Little Red Riding Hood and, all these other primal legends about wolves, that there's a way of, I'm just thinking about how we really reshape that thinking and how we come to terms with the fears that are so visceral?
You know, I think that your point about urbanites living with coyotes is a great thing to think about, because one of the things that is happening in urban communities is people learning and being taught how to live with coyotes, keep their pets safe, not draw them in by leaving out dog food or cat food. I mean, the same thing is true with raccoons. People have raccoons come up in their backyards, even in urban areas, because they're attracted right through your cat door into your house where the cat food is. So I think that there is a real opportunity here for city folks to say, hey, we're learning how to live with our wild neighbors. Turns out we build our cities right on where their habitat used to be, and now that some of them are coming into our backyards, we're figuring out what we need to do to live safely and not harm them, not do things that draw them in. So maybe there's actually a bridge there with the livestock owner community to say, we're finding ways to live non-lethally with wildlife. Let's see if you can do the same. Let's make that a possibility. That's something we can all share.
I'm just trying to imagine that kind of forum. I'm sort of seeing something where we come, you know, at the summit of the Cascades or maybe the summit of the Blue Mountains. We come together as the east and the west parts of Oregon and Washington and try to have a dialogue about wolves and understanding our relationship to nature. It's kind of just this fantasy I'm just having, but I'm wondering, is there any way of maybe bringing together region-wide roundtables of urban and rural people, and particularly eastern Northwesterners and western Northwesterners?
I think we're limited only by the scope of our imagination. I think all kinds of things are possible. Actually, one of the things that occurred to me while you were talking about that was kind of from the business owner perspective as well. You know, people like to say livestock producers out on the east side, they've got a business to run. People on the west side, they don't have any skin in the game. They don't know what it's all about. There's a lot of business owners on the west side, and I think we have some parallels here. What business owner wouldn't want to learn about new science that's going to help you have your business be more sustainable and have your business be more appreciated by the rest of the public that will now want to buy your product because you're using non-lethal methods and keeping native wildlife alive? So I think that there's a number of threads from urban living that could be woven into this story for this joint stakeholder type of discussion.
I know there's a guy who's with Oregon Wild who lives out near Joseph, and he's got a bed and breakfast. I've had him on the show. He's wonderful. I can't remember his name at the moment.
Rob Levin. I know Rob well.
Right. Wonderful guy.
Great colleague.
And he's somebody, I see him as kind of a bridge person, because when I've had him on the show, it was, he was talking about some of the difficulties he has with his neighbors, but he's still there, and having a bed and breakfast is a very visible way of being in the community. I'm wondering, do you know if he's making any inroads there?
He still has lots of people coming to his bed and breakfast. So I hope that that's one way he's making inroads, because I think one of the things that all of us who appreciate wolves and want to see them back would also like to see is a mindset change that wolves provide economic opportunity. The opportunities for wildlife viewing and having tourist dollars come into a community. So, for instance, people come and stay at Rob and his wife Emily's bed and breakfast, and then they can go out and look for wolves or listen to wolf howls or tracks or scats. They're spending money in that community. They're taking photographs. They have memories they take back with them, and they're contributing to the economic well-being of that community. And I think if the livestock owners there can begin to see the economic contribution that comes in from examples like that business and wildlife watching, that maybe there will be the bridge there that you're talking about.
Well, and one of the last things I want to talk about today is kind of the happy stories. And one is the new pack that's living in Wasco County. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about how wolf dispersal is starting to move west in the state and what that might mean for those of us who hang out a lot in the Mount Hood National Forest.
Yeah, so a wolf dispersal into the western part of the state, first of all, depends upon there being a healthy, thriving population in the eastern part of the state. That's the source population for wolves to make it west, which is why it's so important to have this discussion of we need to stop killing wolves on the east side so we can have more wolves coming to the west. Wolves naturally disperse. That's part of their behavior. When they're about 2.5 years old, they tend to leave their birth pack, and they're just like teenagers. They're going off in search of mates and territories of their own. And so the wolves that are making their way west are doing exactly that. They're looking for undeveloped wolf territory. And we talked earlier about whether or not you'd be so lucky to see a wolf in the wild. You may not. They're really, really shy. I would say for anybody who's recreating in the wild in the western part of Oregon, keep your eyes peeled. What an exciting opportunity that would be. And we talked before also about how shy wolves are. They're not a threat to human safety. You know, with all wild animals, one should try to keep them wild and not do things like throw them your sandwich, because that's not good for them either. But they're not going to hurt you. It's not something you have to be concerned about. If you come across a wolf while hiking, as I said, they'll probably see you and go, oh my gosh, and tear off in the opposite direction. But my hope is that as more people are hiking and recreating in Western Oregon, that they will begin to see more wolves there. My fear is that the agency practices is limiting the wolf population, and the poaching that's going on is limiting the ability of wolves to make their way west. There have actually been at least 3 wolves in the southwestern part of Oregon that have been discovered illegally killed, and those have not yet been resolved. So my hope is that recreationists in Western Oregon do have a chance to see wolves.
So, and what's happened with OR7?
So OR7... his saga continues. He's actually a rather amazing wolf. You know, he was in California from December 2011 until March of 2013, left California, came back into California several times that same year and again in 2014. And then in spring of 2014, it was confirmed that he was remaining in southwest Oregon. He's over in the Jackson County general area, and he settled down with a female. And they have formed what's known as the Rogue Pack, because they live in the Rogue River watershed in the Rogue Siskiyou National Forest. And they have had a litter of pups every single spring since 2014. One of his offspring from his very first litter went into California and formed one of California's first wolf packs, the Lassen Pack. Another one of his offspring was seen in California in January of last year. And yet another one of his offspring has been making her way into and out of, hopscotching back and forth across the border from southwestern Oregon into California. I think she's in California right now. And so his legacy continues. It is miraculous how his story became a worldwide phenomenon. It is miraculous that he ended up having his first litter when he was the age that he was, at about, 5 years of age.
Is that old or young?
Around.
Is that old?
Yeah. Well, that's actually old for a wolf. Yeah. Wolves in the wild tend to live only 5 to 6 years at most. They get kicked in the head by that elk that they're hunting. They get hit by cars. They get killed by humans. So that's actually pretty long lived for a wolf in the wild, and he's older than that now.
How old is he now?
So he was born in 2009. So that makes him
nine years old.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yes. And it's amazing because through his story, people learned so much about wolves. They learned that wolves do these long-distance treks. When he was wandering throughout California, from the time he left his birth pack in northeastern Oregon to the time he finally settled down in southwestern Oregon, he had traveled over 4,000 miles. And we know this because he was wearing a radio collar that had GPS and VHF technology on it. Both of those functions have stopped working now. They stopped working about 2 years ago. But because of that collar, people knew where he was traveling and that he was looping back and forth, so they began to understand wolf behavior too. That he was traveling through California, leaving a urine scent mark, and then going back to check out the same place to see if he had any pee mail from a female. And, you know, he didn't. He never did find a mate in California, and he went back into Oregon, and then he found a mate there. So people have learned a lot about wolves from him.
It's interesting. His mate must have made her way down from eastern Oregon as well, but we don't know her story.
That's correct. That's right. We do know from genetics, because some of her scat was collected and DNA tested, we do know that her origin is from two different packs genetics in northeastern Oregon, but we don't know exactly which one she came from.
Well, we hope that OR7's story and his mate, their stories will continue in our minds to help us protect the wolves in Oregon. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Al Marrock.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yes, and we'll talk again soon. I enjoyed this conversation a lot.
Great, me too. Thank you.
We've been talking with Al Marrock Weiss, who's the West Coast Wolf Advocate with the Center for Biological Diversity, and you've been listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you want to hear and you'd like to hear the show or hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later. And I'm not exactly sure when, because our website's been having problems since it was hacked, but hopefully it'll be up in the next day or so and you can hear it. And you can go to kboo.fm/locust-focus. Next week, I'll be talking with Brian Posowitz, who's an attorney for Water Watch Oregon, and Lauren Goldberg, attorney at Columbia Riverkeeper, about CAFOs, confined animal feed operations near the Columbia River. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by some wolves and Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening.